morning. Thanks very much for that introduction. Since football came up, I have to mention that it's not the Steelers are not my favorite team. New York Giants are, even though I've never lived in New York. Grew up in Washington, D.C. Everybody rooted for the Redskins. I was a contrarian even then, so I rooted for the New York Giants. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the recent financial events and government's response to that. And to set the stage, let me just give you a little bit of perspective. In September 2007, U.S. economy was the envy of the world. We'd had 24 consecutive quarters of positive economic growth. The S&P was over 1,500. Inflation was low. Unemployment was low. Everything was really quite hunky-dory. Year and a half later, the situation is obviously incredibly different. All the major economies are in recession. Stock values have declined by something like 50% around the world. And people are seriously talking about another Great Depression, although I think they're being, you know, way, way, way over-pessimistic when they say those things, but they are indeed at least talking in that way. So in response to those events, which are clearly significant, even if they're not a Great Depression, U.S. and other economies have adopted a wide range of policies, such as the bailout, the coordinated interest rates cuts, expansions of deposit insurance, stimulus bills, mortgage bailouts, and so on and so forth. Okay? So I'm going to talk about, first of all, what caused all these events, in my assessment, and then the main pieces of the government's response. Of course, there were seven new initiatives proposed since I stood up here about 4 minutes ago, so I can't cover everything. But let me give you a quick preview. My position on the banks, on the financial sector, is that we should have allowed the process of bankruptcy and FDIC receivership to operate, even though that would have been costly. That a stimulus package, if any, should have consisted of cuts in tax rates, not of increases in spending. The mortgage rescue plan is completely unacceptable in every way, shape, or form. We simply should not have done that. And that the budget outlook, sort of more broadly, is way worse than the administration is letting on. Now, they may get lucky, but if we take reasonable estimates of how things are likely to play out, the budget situation is really quite awful for quite a while to come. So what caused the crisis? Lots of people have talked about lots of things, and many of those things clearly played some role and have some merit as part of the discussion. Wall Street greed, interpreted in a certain way, securitization of mortgages and other asset-backed securities, inadequate or inappropriate regulation, rating agencies that were asleep at the wheel, and so on. All of that is certainly relevant, but I want to convince you that the crucial problem, the fundamental underlying problem, was two misguided federal policies. So the first of those is the long-standing attempt by the U.S., other economies as well, to expand home ownership. So we've had Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, the federal home loan banks, the mortgage deductibility of mortgage interest, and many, many other policies that, going back at least to the Great Depression, have tried to increase the fraction of Americans that live in homes. Now, the negative effects of a lot of that were not immediately obvious, were not obviously huge for quite a few decades, but starting in the early 90s under the Clinton administration, that attempt to expand home ownership started to focus even more on expanding home ownership amongst low-income households who probably did not have the wherewithal to be affording homes, at least not homes of significant size. But there was a huge subsidy being applied that got much worse after some accounting scandals at Fannie and Freddie in the early 2000s. And so the U.S., from mid-1990s on, has experienced a huge boom in housing prices, in housing construction, in home ownership, all in a way that's very, very implausible compared to historical patterns, and that just doesn't make good economic sense based on any fundamentals. Okay? So the first thing to note about that is the federal government never had any business intervening in the home ownership decision. There is no rational economic argument, or any argument I know of, that says that the market for buying and selling homes is imperfect in some way, which requires government. Construction firms have plenty of incentive to build homes and sell them. People who have the wherewithal have plenty of incentive to buy homes if they want to live in homes instead of apartments. There's just no reason that there should have been any intervention. It was clearly, unambiguously, a backdoor attempt to redistribute income, okay, in a way that was off budget, that was non-transparent, and especially when it became a way of transferring income to people who probably couldn't afford those homes on average, then it was bound to fail at some point because it was fundamentally misguided from the start. Now, that first misguided policy is particularly problematic, especially the provision of risky debt to low-income homeowners, okay, because of the second misguided federal policy, which is the long-standing practice of bailing out private risk-taking. So that's also gone on for decades. It's been especially focused on bailing out banks, okay, in the U.S. and other country history, although not exclusively, as with auto industries and steel industries and some other examples. Okay? But it's clearly been a persistent feature of major countries' economic policies. In the recent events, one particular aspect was Federal Reserve policy. Okay? The Federal Reserve quite clearly, implicitly, and almost explicitly was saying to the markets, don't worry about the fact that there's a housing bubble. We'll lower interest rates and keep them low enough to prevent there from being any crash in asset prices. That sort of implicit policy is widely referred to as the Greenspan put. Okay, the Greenspan basically selling the market an option that they can get out, okay, if things turn bad. Okay, and so there's been this understanding widespread that markets were not going to have to bear the full losses from risky behavior. That history of bailouts, okay, therefore meant that not only did markets have some reason to expect their losses to be cushioned, at the same time, because of Fannie, Freddie, the CRA, and so on, markets were under extreme pressure to expand the subprime, Alt-A, other types of debt. So, and it was profitable to do so for quite a few years, so there was no reason for the private sector, for the banking and financial sector, not to go along with, okay, the encouragement to extend all of this credit to risky borrowers. Okay? But of course, it was unsustainable. At some point, it was clear that the amount of home ownership, the amount of capital going to housing as opposed to R&D and factories and equipment was going to be inappropriate for the economy. So there had to be a crash at some point. Not entirely clear what caused the crash in this case. It may have been the spike in oil prices. It may have been just that things ran out of steam. But in any case, it was inevitable that those two things were going to bump up against reality. So my interpretation of what happened puts primary blame on federal policy. Okay? Now, of course, things like Wall Street greed, okay, were involved. Okay? If by greed you mean profit-seeking behavior, then of course there was profit-seeking behavior. And what's also clear is that we want private companies to engage in profit-seeking behavior, okay, as long as the incentives that they face, the ways in which they can make profits, okay, don't involve any perverse incentives like giving a mortgage to someone who has no income and no assets. Okay? When policy encourages that, of course, profit-seeking behavior is not socially beneficial, but when profit-seeking behavior goes to people who can afford houses, it is in the interest of society more generally. Okay? So the fundamental problem was the policy. By changing the perverse incentives in policy, by eliminating Fannie, Freddie, and all that stuff, okay, we would have left the private sector with the right incentives, okay, and therefore we would not have this mess. It's silly to whine about Wall Street being greedy or any private actor being greedy. That's a fact of life, and it's a good fact of life so long as there aren't perverse incentives put in place by policy. More generally, it's hard to imagine that merely the introduction of derivatives, the introduction of securitization, bad rating agencies, and those sorts of things could by themselves have led to anything like the magnitude of boom and bust that we experience if there hadn't been this notion in the back of everyone's mind that the government will bail us out, okay, if things go badly. Indeed, it's not always appropriate to argue by anecdote, but an anecdote can illustrate. There was a woman on NPR about 6 months ago, right after all the stuff hit the fan, okay, who called in and said, you know, my husband works on Wall Street. He's involved in creating all these CDOs and ABSs and blah, 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 blah. And I keep saying to him, this is smoke and mirrors. Isn't it all going to come crashing down? And he says, of course it is. But, you know, the government will bail us out when it crashes, so don't worry about it. Okay? Now, that's just one example, but that's exactly symptomatic of what I'm arguing. Now, what were the government responses? Okay, so the first, the most controversial, and the one that I'm going to talk about the most, is the Treasury bailout. The bailout was an attempt to stabilize the financial markets, avoid a credit freeze recession. It's motivated by the fact that lots of major Wall Street institutions, banks and investment banks, were facing imminent collapse, okay, because of the rapid decline, the dramatic decline in the value of their mortgage-backed securities. And the initial version of the bailout basically gave money to a bunch of these banks in exchange for the U.S. getting ownership stakes, getting various kinds of stocks. Now, before we critique that, it's useful to ask, what was the alternative? Because lots of people talk as though there was no alternative to bailing them out, as though we had to do that. Well, that's, of course, completely insane, as just as a matter of logic. You always have a choice. You may not like all the other choices, but you always have a choice. So we could have done nothing. But by doing nothing, I mean we could have done nothing new. We could have just stuck with the existing policies that were available, which means bankruptcy like Chapter 11, okay, or FDIC receivership, okay, in the case of banks. The details about whether it's receivership or bankruptcy, I'm going to gloss over for today. It basically has to do with whether it's a bank or a non-bank. Okay, the key thing is some sort of orderly temporary control of failing institutions by a bankruptcy court or by FDIC for the purpose of liquidating it, selling off the assets, okay, zeroing out the stakeholders, the equity holders and the creditors, and turning the rest over to some part of the private sector that is willing to own it at some price. When you do that, taxpayer funds are in general not necessarily needed, and at a minimum are needed to a much, much lower extent than in the bailout approach. In many cases, there would have been no need for any taxpayer injections for those appropriate transfers to have taken place. So let's think about the bankruptcy approach, okay, versus the bailout, what we did, from three perspectives: distributional, long-run efficiency, or short-run efficiency. From the distributional perspective, it's a no-brainer. The bailout approach took money from the general taxpayer and gave it to people who willingly, knowingly, repeatedly took a huge amount of risk, okay, hoping that they'd get bailed out by everybody else. It's completely crazy, okay, to transfer money, okay, to such people. Okay? Under bankruptcy, the people who take most of the loss, maybe all of the loss, are the equity holders and the creditors, okay, of these institutions. That's appropriate because they win on the upside when there's money to be made, and they should lose on the downside, okay, when there's a hit to be taken. Okay? So distributionally, we clearly did the wrong thing. From the perspective of long-run efficiency, okay, it's also relatively straightforward. To begin, by the end of 2005, it should have been apparent that the U.S. was fundamentally misaligned. It's trivial to look at data on residential and non-residential investment and see that we had way overinvested in housing and way underinvested in factories and plants and equipment. So, in effect, we needed a recession. We needed a period to adjust, to do much, much less housing construction, okay, because we'd way overbuilt, okay, probably to do more non-residential construction and get our economy back to a position where it had an appropriate balance between the different types of capital. Okay? More broadly, of course, failure is an essential aspect of capitalism. Economists, libertarians think that failures show that capitalism is working, not that it's not working, because that means we're releasing resources from bad uses to good uses. Okay? Other problems from a long-run perspective with the bailout approach. The bailout distracts attention from the fact the government created the problem. Bailout creates moral hazards going forward, meaning more excessive risk-taking. Bailout encourages inappropriate goals like propping up insolvent banks. Bailout gives government an ownership stake in these institutions, which means that politics and not economics is going to decide what these firms invest in, and it sets the wrong precedent for other industries. So there's really only one possible argument for the bailout as opposed to the bankruptcy approach. That might make sense if bankruptcy imposes some externality, or what you might also call a spillover. Okay? And the story for that goes as follows. It says, when a given bank fails, okay, it loses something that you could call intermediation capital, the ability to make loans. And the idea is any given bank knows a particular sector of the economy, a particular region of the country, a particular kind of loan market. It has some specialized knowledge. And if the bank fails, that specialized knowledge gets destroyed, and therefore, going forward, no one else can easily make those kinds of loans, at least not in the short term, because we've destroyed the one institution that had that particular knowledge. Okay? Now, if one bank, that happened to one bank, you'd say, well, that's not a big deal. There are zillions of banks that have lots of knowledge. If, however, one large bank fails and loses its intermediation capital, and it defaults on obligations to a lot of other banks and forces some of them to fail, then you might worry that that contagion could lead to a lot of intermediation capital, a lot of ability to make productive loans disappearing in a short period of time. So that story, and I think it's not a heck of a lot more than the story that some economists have told, okay, has some plausibility. It doesn't sound all wrong. Each of the pieces has some degree of sort of reasonableness, but it has two key weaknesses, one theoretical and one empirical. The theoretical weakness is, if a bank fails, but its assets, okay, and its employees get bought up by another bank, then there's no reason for that intermediation capital to disappear. It just gets transferred to someone else. If you think that the good ideas about making productive loans are in the brains of the people who are working at the failed bank, those people are probably going to go work in some other financial institution, okay, a hedge fund, an insurance company, other bank, so you're not necessarily going to lose all that intermediation capital as a result of the failure. The empirical problem with that story is there's not such great evidence to support it. Okay? There's some evidence which claims to support it. It shows that there's a correlation between bank failures and declines in output. But of course, declines in output should cause bank failures, so we don't know which is causing which, okay? And it's very hard to figure out any way that we could actually show that quantitatively bank failures really lead to a huge amount of excess loss over and above the loss that has to be realized if some negative shock hits the economy. And that, in some sense, is the crucial thing. Clearly, housing prices have declined. Because housing prices have declined, somebody was worse off. Okay? So maybe that's the first bank in the chain, which takes most of the hit. Or maybe the first bank of the chain passes some of the hit along because of its counterparty claims, et cetera, to some other bank. But that hit has to be taken, and reasonable estimates for the U.S. are that was a big hit. Is it $8 trillion of housing wealth might convince yourself of? Okay, that doesn't show that there's any externality, that there's any extra loss from the failures. It just shows somebody has to experience the loss the economy has already taken. Even worse, it's quite possible that the bailout made the credit situation worse. Why? Because when banks hear that Treasury is dangling hundreds of billions of dollars out there to purchase their toxic assets, what are they going to do? Sell their assets with a nominal value of 100 for 20 cents on the dollar, or say, no, I'm going to hold on to these assets for a while because maybe the government's going to buy them at 80 cents on the dollar. Okay? So clearly, Wall Street was going to freeze the second Paulson got in front of the cameras because they wanted to figure out how much money is available and how can we get some of it. Let's not realize any losses we don't absolutely have to realize because Treasury is going to bail us out. Okay, so going forward, I think there's very little indication going forward on the financial situation that Treasury is really moving toward allowing more bankruptcy. They clearly are very hesitant about that. There are some good reasons and maybe some bad reasons. Treasury, I'm not suggesting the Treasury should go outside existing law. I'm not suggesting they should just say, we need to nationalize all the banks and zero out all these interparty claims and reorganize things. They should wait until the conditions are such under existing law that it's clear a given bank has failed. Okay? And maybe they're not there yet, partially because it's hard to value the underlying assets. Okay? And the bankruptcy approach is messy, and there's some legal issues about banks versus bank holding companies. But what they should stop doing is giving the banks money. Okay? And they should be open to the possibility of allowing the bankruptcy approach to be used when it's appropriate under existing law. As long as they keep giving banks money, nothing good is going to happen in the financial sector to clean out all the mess. And of course, the PIP, the latest new government treasury program, public investment private partnership or something like that, is just another handout to the banks. Okay? It sets up a system where some private money, a very small amount, is combined with some government money, a very small amount, and a big loan fully guaranteed by government to buy the toxic assets of the bank. Okay, so what are the incentives of the private sector? Well, they're hardly putting any money in. The thing turns out, the toxic assets they buy turn out are not worth anything. They haven't lost much. Okay, if they are worth a lot, they make some money. Okay? But the Treasury is guaranteeing it all. Reasonable estimates are that the toxic assets are not worth very much, and so this is just another way of transferring more resources to the banks, holding all the toxic assets by buying them at, in effect, inflated prices. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the stimulus and other parts of the Obama's program quickly. So in mid-February, we got the $787 billion stimulus that consisted of spending increases and tax cuts. Okay, the spending is for energy, education, infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. I want to talk about the spending side first and then come back to taxes. There are two possible arguments for more spending. Okay? One is we should be doing the spending completely independent of the recession. This is good spending that's going to be productive for the economy. The second argument is the Keynesian argument that many of you were sort of suffered through when you were students long ago. Okay? And that says that creating demand is good because it stimulates the economy and it's not too fussy about whether you're spending it on good things, on productive things. Okay, so on the first of those two lines of argument, the notion that for an economy like the U.S., given the amount of spending it has, that there's a lot more productive spending to be done, that case just to me doesn't pass the laugh test. Okay? Indeed, I can think of zillions and zillions of dollars worth of current spending that don't make any sense, from wasteful transportation, things like the Big Dig, to drug prohibition, to wars in Afghanistan, agricultural subsidies, rebuilding levees in New Orleans, middle class entitlements, and billions, billions of more things at the state level, at the local level, plus all sorts of crazy rules and regulations which make things inefficient and so on and so forth. So there may be a few hidden small things in the huge stimulus that actually make sense on cost-benefit grounds, but that's really, really unconvincing. Okay? The Keynesian argument, the argument that as long as the government takes money, pays people to dig ditches and fill them back up, that stimulates the economy, okay, deserves to be thought about carefully. Now, I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying people should really think about the underlying assumptions. The way GDP is valued in economic accounts is if the government spends $100 paying someone to sit at home, do nothing, okay, pay someone to go out and dig ditches, okay, that counts as $100 of extra output that we produced. Okay, so by definition, when the government spends all this money, it's to some extent creating more output, but not in any meaningful way unless it's on a good project. Okay? The Keynesian assumption might, under some strong assumptions, be plausible in the short run, okay, but it clearly makes no sense in the long run. As an economy has resources that are fully utilized, having the government do inherently wasteful stuff can't possibly be good for the economy. And the evidence, okay, is that it doesn't particularly. The evidence that there's a multiplier is actually quite mixed and overall doesn't make a very good case for the Keynesian spending. Moreover, the usual claim is that this Keynesian spending will be temporary. We're just going to do it to stimulate and then we're going to get rid of it. But of course, we all know that government programs last forever. Okay, so using the argument that we can spend on anything, even if it's worthless, okay, is incredibly dangerous because we'll get stuck with that stuff for a long time. So the defense of the extra spending in the stimulus, I think, was incredibly weak. On tax cuts, it's not so bad. First of all, okay, Washington keeps forgetting, okay, that in the standard Keynesian textbook model that many of you learned, tax cuts also stimulate the economy for Keynesian reasons. So even if you want to be a strict Keynesian, should be perfectly happy with tax cuts, okay, as opposed to spending increases. Okay? Secondly, tax cuts make sense even if you don't buy any of the Keynesian stuff because tax cuts improve incentives. Tax cuts mean that people and businesses get to keep more of what they produce and earn, so they have more incentive to work harder and produce more. Okay? So my assessment is the program should have consisted 100% of tax cuts, in particular of elimination of the corporate income tax. Okay? For any given size increase in the deficit that we were willing to tolerate, doing it via tax cuts would have made far more sense than spending. Okay, and so we got the stimulus bill, you know, entirely wrong. I'm not 100% convinced we should have had anything that was a stimulus, that we should have worried about the state of the economy at all. But if you were going to do it, do things you should have done otherwise, okay, and that would have meant tax cuts, okay, rather than the spending increases. Okay. Briefly, on the Obama mortgage plan, okay, the mortgage plan uses $275 billion in taxpayer funds to help homeowners refinance at lower rates, to subsidize payments from borrowers to lenders, to get them to modify loans, and so on and so forth. It also gave another $200 billion to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Okay? It's exactly the wrong approach. The aim is to reduce foreclosures, okay, so the delinquent or near-delinquent borrowers can stay in their homes. That sounds like a laudable goal, okay, a reasonable goal, but it ignores a fundamental reality. The money government's going to give to existing homeowners, to delinquent homeowners, comes from somebody else. So what the plan is doing is penalizing relatively responsible homeowners or non-homeowners, everybody who pays taxes, okay, in order to reward people who took relatively big risks, who should have known or certainly should have had some inkling that the loans they were being offered, okay, were too good to be true, and indeed they frequently were too good to be true. So it's exactly the wrong medicine, okay, in terms of giving people the right incentives about whether to borrow, whether to try to be a homeowner or not. More generally, it maintains, okay, the existing framework that says the government should be in the business of promoting homeownership. We got into the situation we're in because the government took this policy of trying to promote homeownership, and the mortgage plan is exactly the wrong thing. It exactly continues that misguided policy and doesn't do anything to get us to a situation where people make decisions based on their own resources and really have to think about bearing the consequences of the decisions that they make. So lastly, on the Obama budget, okay, at one level, it's actually honest. Okay, at many levels, it's not especially forthcoming. But at one level, I think it's fairly honest. It is totally unapologetic about the fact that the design is to remake the size and scope of government. Okay, there is no question that the people advocating this budget want way more government intervention with respect to unions, energy, healthcare, infrastructure, okay, and a number of other things. Basically, the crisis has given Democrats the opportunity to get through a whole bunch of things they would have wanted to do regardless of whether there had been a crisis.
okay, and that they've been trying to pursue for a long time. And Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff for Obama, said it very clearly. He said, you should never let a good crisis go to waste. And he meant exactly, this is the Democrats' opportunity to engineer the things that they were in favor of. Okay? So they're entitled to their views, but that doesn't necessarily make them right. Okay? Now, as a matter of accounting, okay, I think that they're not being especially forthcoming. The budget seems wildly optimistic. Even as bad as it is, even as high as the numbers are, they're wildly optimistic. So many of the things in the stimulus package that are supposed to be temporary are not going to be temporary. Okay? They may not get to continue forever, but there will be all sorts of pieces that people say, oh, we need them for another 2 years, another 5 years, and a lot of it will go on for a long time. So their current forecast of how bad the budget is assume that the stimulus disappears in approximately a year and a half. That's not going to be true for a significant fraction of it. Okay? Their growth assumptions seem to be on the optimistic side. I'm not a forecaster, but their consensus private forecast would suggest that they're assuming more economic growth than the typical private forecaster out there. So if economic growth is slower, then their budget deficits are going to be bigger. Okay? Their revenue forecasts are always going to be sort of too optimistic on how much extra revenue they're going to get from a tax increase. They're actually forced to do this by current law. They're forced to make what's called a static forecast. Assume there are no behavioral responses to an increase in tax rate. But of course, there are responses by the underlying economy to changes in tax rates. For example, the higher marginal rates on income might induce some second earners to simply withdraw from the labor force entirely, in which case the amount of tax revenues collected is going to be much less than forecast by the static methods. And they know that, okay, but those amounts are significant. And so again, the deficits are going to be even worse. I think perhaps most importantly, the new initiatives that they're talking about, say for healthcare, okay, are going to cost a zillion times more than they're currently admitting, because that's the iron law of government spending. If you start on the big dig and say it's going to cost $1.5 billion, you could have bet, okay, it was going to cost $15 billion, not $1.5 billion. And the same is true of every government program that's ever been enacted. So I think we should expect huge, huge deficits if the Obama administration gets even a modest fraction of all the things that it's been proposing. Now, on the merits, okay, the stunning thing about the Obama proposals is that there's almost nothing that you can defend from the perspective of efficiency. It's all about redistribution. It's not especially redistribution to the poor. It's redistribution to Democratic interest groups, to unions, to the Green Lobby, the education lobby, the healthcare industry, and so on and so forth. And, you know, that's not unexpected, but it's really, really scary, because at some point, the greater and greater level of government intervention will really affect the size of the pie. Okay? And we are at a point now where you can convince yourself maybe that as much bad government as we haven't fundamentally made it impossible for the U.S. economy to grow and be successful. But if we start looking more like France, although France is starting to look kind of good compared to the U.S., but if we start to have 10 or 20% more of GDP controlled by the government, the effects on growth, the size of output, and economic sort of freedom and liberty more generally, okay, are going to be seriously affected. So to conclude, the crisis, in my assessment, resulted at its most fundamental level from government policies. Lots of private actions and other things helped transmit it and amplify it. But to fix it, we should have fixed government policies. The policy response that we've undertaken have been misdirected at best. Rather than undertaking massive new policies, we should have tried to eliminate pre-existing bad policies and focused on efficiency rather than redistribution. In particular, doing nothing, that is, nothing new, just living with existing procedures, would have been much better than anything that we've done. So I'm sorry that's not especially cheery, but that's my assessment. Thank you very much.